Good morning, and welcome to WDRT's Conversations. I'm Dina Eccles. I like to think of this time we have together as an opportunity to bring perspectives and actions that we may not have known or even thought about. I try to have people who are actively engaged in creating a more just and livable world for all of us. And so this morning, I'm introducing someone who I've grown to know over the past 7 months, and I've been touched by his clarity and uncompromising humanity. I hope you enjoy this conversation, but more, I hope it inspires you to learn and to take action. My guest today is Alon Chavoya. Alon is the outreach chair of the Milwaukee Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression and the secretary of the National Alliance. He organizes for the liberation of oppressed people in Milwaukee, especially those impacted by police crimes. His work is for transparency and accountability from law enforcement, and that goes hand in hand with building community power to hold police accountable. Alon's energies are dedicated to being with the people of Milwaukee and responding to the issues that matter most to them, such as Palestinian liberation and putting an end to police crimes. Wow, that's just such a beautiful intro. Okay, welcome, Alon. So really happy to have you today.
Hey, good morning, Dina. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So I want to just dive right into what informs you. How have you come to hone your passion for people who are oppressed?
Yeah, so it really started for me just growing up as the child of Mexican immigrants here in Milwaukee. My parents came in 1993, and I was born shortly after. And just seeing the disparities in Milwaukee, particularly those of us who grew up in a poor working class neighborhood, particularly immigrant neighborhood, and seeing just the reality of that and seeing the injustice that came with those, just that reality and trying to make sense of it as a child. Granted, as a child, I wasn't, aware of the powers that be that made it that way in Milwaukee. But as I grew up, that was always a sensitivity of mine. And in high school, that's when I started becoming more active in the community, particularly working with, working for immigrant rights. And so that was always something I carried with me, just the grave injustice I saw in Milwaukee. But also when I first was able to go back to Mexico with my family, once they got their green card in 2010, seeing the connection of those struggles of the reality that people face in Mexico, caused by a lot of just, terrible, terrible policies that had nothing, that it wasn't the responsibility of people. And so that's something that really motivated me when I would be told by certain people, like, oh, the reason why people are poor is because they choose to be or they don't know how to act a certain way. And so it was always blaming the individuals. But then I started seeing things and connecting, these issues in a more broad way and seeing the different systems at play. And so that's really what motivated me to not blame people for certain things. Granted, sometimes, people should take some accountability with things, but it was ultimately recognizing the humanity in each other. And that's something that has guided me throughout my entire life and has led me to where I am today. It's a bit of a long story, but, we can get into it later on. But that's sort of the general gist of it.
Well, no, we can keep getting into it because that to me is the key, and have getting to know you and listening to you on Zoom calls. We met briefly in Milwaukee once, but
right.
Seeing your care about all people and how that motivates you, and I think that is so important in us moving all together forward. And yes, I'd love to hear. We have an hour, which is nice. We get to, we get to cover.
Right.
So could you elaborate maybe a little bit more on the overall systems as you see it, particularly how it's influenced people in Mexico? I mean, like, what kinds of things did you start to realize?
Yeah, so, like I said, my parents came in 93. This was around the time that you start thinking of things like the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Right.
That the way we, I come to describe it these days, it it opened the borders for capital, but it closed the borders for people.
Mm.
Because at that time, you start seeing, you know, with the, you start getting into the Clinton administration that developed some very, very harsh immigration policies.
Mm-hmm.
And people tend to think like, oh, you know, this is just the Republicans that, you know, are anti-immigrant and it's the Democrats who are better. But it's really been both parties that have, over the time, created policies and created the system that we have today that leads to what you see in Eagle Pass, right, in the last several months. And so my parents, you know, they came at around that time where you start allowing different companies to move across borders. But that really meant that big U.S. corporations were able to enter Mexico at an unprecedented rate. And they started, you know, taking the jobs of the Mexicans there and, like, really giving them terrible jobs. Like, the companies that were Mexican-owned were undermined. Local farmers were undermined. You know, they used to be able to sell their own produce at a certain rate that kept them afloat. And then come in the big mega farms that sell, you know, this GMO corn that's, like, the main corn now. And it takes away the richness of not just the richness of the cuisine and the richness of the crops, but also the livability of people all throughout Mexico who are now out of jobs. So what happens when the opportunities for you and your homeland aren't there?
Mm.
Well, people choose to leave.
Right.
Right? And actually, I wouldn't even say choose. They're sort of forced to leave, right? It's not
right.
much of a decision. It's sort of made for you at that point.
Right.
And so that's something that I came to understand and at the international level. But the more I started getting involved with, you know, issues of police killings here in Milwaukee over the last 4 years, you know, following the George Floyd uprising, I noticed similar trends in Milwaukee, you know, at a local scale. So, for instance, Milwaukee, right, used to be a booming city. At one point, you know, places like Bronzeville were exemplary for African-American communities in the nation, right? This was like the 50s. And somewhere along the line, you know, they start building these highway systems that cut through neighborhoods like Bronzeville, the big manufacturing jobs that used to be pretty stable jobs for people in Milwaukee were outsourced. And so come the 70s, parts of Milwaukee are just completely deteriorated.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you see, right? People say, oh, it's just these people are the ones that are, you know, criminals. They're just, you know, again, blaming the people and mm-hmm. not seeing the bigger picture of how it is that through the deindustrialization of Milwaukee, the elimination of public services in Milwaukee in the last 50 years. And at that point, when all those things start decreasing, the funding for police starts increasing drastically. So then, of course, you start seeing, quote unquote, more crime in certain parts of Milwaukee, right? When you mm-hmm. take away access to good education, access to good health care, access to public services, and then you start just putting, you know, a cop at each block, of course they're going to see what they want to see in there, and so the rates are going to go up. So that's how I started to see those connections too, of you take away resources from communities and you give them to the big corporations and to their guard dogs that are the police, and you just let go of the people and blame the people for every issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is amazing. Your passion and your clarity really come through, and it's so important because, you know, out here we're rural and we weren't dealing with industry, although I think that's changing as more and more of the industrial agriculture is
mm-hmm.
is coming through, and I think more and more people are starting to pay closer attention. And some are not. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to have you on to take a snapshot of what's actually happening to people. So that led you to becoming part of the Milwaukee Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, right?
Yeah. So I got my activism early on in high school. And that's the same time that I actually started I found my love for philosophy in high school.
Uh-huh. Something we share. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I kind of knew at that point, like, okay, at that point I was already accepted into college, and I was like, all right, I'll go and study philosophy. And so once I got to college and my undergrad, I did pursue my study of philosophy. And the reason why I was really drawn to it is just at high school, I was reading, you know, I was reading the biography of Che Guevara, and there he talks about a lot of different philosophers. So I was like, huh. I was like, what drew him to that? And so there was something, the humanism behind it. That's what he always emphasized. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, there's something there for me, right, to chew on and to make sense of this world that I'm living in, right? And so once I got to college, I wanted to study that. But the more you get into, you know, philosophy at that level, it's sort of more... more rigorous, right? It's a very thorough science of sorts. And so I sort of got a little moved away from the activism, even though I was pretty active still on campus for different initiatives, such as, you know, solidarity with my Palestinian siblings. And however, I thought that that route would allow me to do the things I wanted to do, which was to work with my community. So I was taking the route of studying philosophy and pursuing a graduate degree with it. So I was able to do a master's degree. And in 2019, I was accepted into a PhD program at Northwestern in philosophy. And that was actually going to be the first time I've actually lived somewhere outside of Milwaukee. So I was already moving to Chicago. I moved in September of 2019, and I'm only there for about 5 months. And then, you know, COVID hits. And... Right. I was like, okay. So 5 months later, I'm back in Milwaukee because, you know, Illinois was pretty quick in shutting everything down. And so, at that point, I remember we had no idea how long this would last. We had no idea what was going on. And so I was like, well, if we're going to be socially isolating, I might as well just come back and be with my family and be with my community here in Milwaukee, since this is where I have my roots. And funny enough, I'm almost done with my program. This is my fifth year, and I've got 5 years of funding. And I pretty much completed here in Milwaukee. I didn't go back to Chicago. I just stayed here because I reaffirmed my roots in Milwaukee in 2020, right? You know, I'm in the middle of this program. It's my first year. And... you know, in May, you just see that footage of George Floyd and that officer kneeling on his neck and killing him. And that sort of detonated this wave of enormous struggle. And here in Milwaukee, we unfortunately have a long history of police killings, too. And a month before George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, there was a young man named Joel Acevedo, a Puerto Rican man here in Milwaukee, who was choked to death by a police officer. They were at a party together, and that police officer proceeded to choke him for several minutes. And so there was something that resonated in Milwaukee, and so you saw, you know, enormous protests, and that was around the time that the Milwaukee Alliance Against Race and Political Repression was refounded in Milwaukee. And so I saw how diligent they were in organizing. I saw how sharp they were, even though it was a small, lean crew at the time. I was really gravitated towards them because I saw that they had a clear message and a clear strategy for how to organize that. In a time of chaos, you know, it's really important to have so that you're able to guide people in certain ways, right, and to be a bit more effective. And, yeah, I joined them in 2020, and I've been with them ever since, and... it's one of the, in my opinion, one of the best decisions I've made in my life.
Wow, this is really wonderful. I knew I would be learning more having you on, which is always why I also pick people to have a conversation with so that I could understand more deeply. You know, it's too easy to just get wrapped up in our own personal lives and not realize what's happening around us. And Milwaukee can seem really, well, it is. It's like 3.5 hours away, but it's not far away. And a lot of the things that are happening could easily be happening here. Actually, I'm becoming aware of some movements of things that are making me a little nervous, which we don't have to get into at this moment. But So I think it's really good for people to be thinking, you know, like, how did we get here? How do we have this? Why are these separations? Why are these walls so great? Why have we not been able to stop police violence? You know, there's a lot of back the badge out here, and I get it, you know, and I get that it's just a slogan that people use, and I don't think they fully understand, everybody doesn't anyway, the repercussions of that choice that they're making. And I saw that part of what that organization that you're involved with is doing is trying to create a civilian police accountability council. And I think that that is a really critical thing that a lot of communities are trying to move towards. I know a lot of indigenous, you know, tribal areas are trying to do similar things. Could you explain the importance of that?
Yeah. So the main, you could say, sort of North Star that guides the National Alliance, and so we're the Milwaukee chapter of the National Alliance that has it has chapters in across, I think we're almost close to 30 cities now in the U.S. I heard there were two new cities that recently were reformed, some chapters, I think Detroit and Oakland, which what's important there is because the mission for what we call community control of the police, that goal is one that originates with the Black Panthers. And so that's why I'm glad that we, you know, we have reestablished a chapter in Oakland and have that history to pull from. Because we saw the issues of policing. And, you know, these are not issues that are new. Like I said, these go back several decades, if not longer, right, depending on where you want to locate the formation of police in this country.
Mm.
And so this question of community control, it really is one that is a practical one that's, you know, grounded in this notion of empowering a community to be able to determine its own fate. You know, I have to keep pulling from Milwaukee to make sense of this all, right? This is where I organize, this is where I live. And in Milwaukee, when we look at something as, you know, like the city budget, you know, Milwaukee has a it's the largest city budget in the state. And about half of that budget goes to policing.
Wow.
Yeah, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars each year going into policing. And they justify this with a variety of reasons, right? They'll justify it by saying, oh, crime rates are up, even though statistically crime rates are down, specifically violent crimes in the last 2 years, I believe. But yet the budget continues to go up and up. They'll justify it by saying that. They'll justify it with a variety of reasons, saying, well, we need to keep our community safe. So I think that's where this important notion comes, right? How do you keep communities safe, and how do communities have a say in what that safety looks like? And that's something that's missing in not just Milwaukee, but all throughout the U.S., where people don't have a say in how it is that their city functions. Right, we like to think that just because we go and vote every so often, right, every like 2 years or whenever there's special elections, or every 4 years if people only vote during presidential elections, and there's not really a lot of direct democratic say that people will have into anything. Like I said, the city budget, they say that they have public hearings for city budgets, but they're usually held during you know, during morning hours when most people are out at work. So there's not really a lot of opportunity for direct participation in how a city gets funded and how it spends its money. Something like even police reforms. Here in Milwaukee, we used to have we still have it, but it's part of the state mandate to create the Fire and Police Commission, or sometimes they're called the Police and Fire Commission, depending on which area of Wisconsin you're in. So I'm not sure if like the Viroqua, Driftless area have a fire and police commission. I'm assuming they do, but I'm just not sure which municipality it would be.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're the ones that are supposed to, according to the state statute, they're allowed to create policies for and edit policies for, you know, the police department. And so in Milwaukee, that, you know, the last probably 5 years or so, they've passed a couple of important policies, one of them being a policy to ban chokeholds. That was passed in 2020 or 2021, if I'm not mistaken. And last year, almost about a little bit over a year ago now, they passed a policy to release the footage of critical incidents. So whether it's an officer-involved shooting or, you know, an officer brutalizing someone, that footage needs to be made public now in Milwaukee. And so they have a window of time of 15 days to release that footage publicly. But there's also a caveat there to release the footage to the victim's next of kin within 48 hours. So we let that struggle to get that passed, but it took us 2 years to pass that. And immediately after it gets passed on April 20th, the next day, April 21st of 2023, the Milwaukee Police Association, which is the so-called union that represents the police, they sue the city and put a temporary injunction on that policy, preventing it from, you know, going into place. And so even that struggle to get a policy like that, first of all, it took us, like I said, 2 years. And that's because we had to go through the only sort of body that actually has this power to create policy. And it was a big struggle, like, you know, and even when we get it passed, it gets negated by this other entity that has an incredible amount of power in not just the city, but the state. And so what's funny is you have that struggle, right, with the body cam footage, you know, being ironed out. But then that summer, Milwaukee as a city is heading towards fiscal insolvency, right, basically going bankrupt because of the amount of debt that it's getting into that's mainly driven by the pension of the police officers. They just can't keep up with it. It's just out of control how much spending there is. So the city's going broke.
Wow.
And so at that time, you have a city that's in dire need of funds, which it has. It's just, you know, obviously spending, like I said, about 50% of those funds going towards policing. And it refuses to do anything about that. It just has to pull money from elsewhere. And so at that time in that summer, you probably remember the Act 12 that passed. It started as the shared revenue bill in Milwaukee that, you know, it was going to raise the amount of shared revenue that Milwaukee gets after, you know, pays taxes. And I don't think Milwaukee had gotten an increase in its shared revenue in about like 10 or 20 years, something pretty alarming. And so Milwaukee, in order to get an increase in that shared revenue, had to pass a sales tax at both the city and the county level. However, that sales tax, which was at the city of 2% increase, so if people come to Milwaukee, the city, you'll notice that now there's a 2% increase in the taxes. And at the county, I think it was 0.7. So, you know, you're going to get a nice little increase there when people come shopping and whatnot. But that money that gets generated through that tax can only be spent on policing and law enforcement.
Wow.
So that's right. It's like we can't even use that money for our needs.
Right. Got it. I need to take a moment here to just let people know, if they're just tuning in, that this show is WDRT's Conversations. My name is Dina Eccles, and my guest is Alon Chavoya. And he is a Milwaukee resident, and he's very passionate about helping change the way we approach police crimes and the way we look at how our communities can be more involved in police accountability. And you've been talking about that and beautifully helping understand all the implications around it. And I just keep thinking that one of the ways that we miss being able to make these changes more quickly is because we're so fear-led, you know? People are so afraid. It's like we have to protect, you know, security is like become the number one profession practically in this. And I hate it. I just hate it. I hate that every thought has to be, how do I protect myself? How do I protect my property? You know, all of those things. And that fear that is, I think, very intentionally instilled in us keeps us from understanding one another, you know? So I don't know if you want to comment on that, but it just...
No, I think that's a very important important aspect of this all. And it just goes to show how it is that community safety has become equivalent, right? Like it's almost like a mathematical equation, like community safety equals more police, or, you know, inverted, right? More police equals community safety. And that's sort of the formula that we're fed all throughout. I know that people who are not from Milwaukee, the main news pieces they get from Milwaukee are fear driven, right?
Absolutely.
It's like, oh, this many shootings, this much crime, all these, you know, horrible, horrible stories that you hear. So then people ask, well, what can be done about all the crime in Milwaukee? What can be done about all of these, you know, ugly stories we hear that are scary and alarming to people? Which, I mean, I would be scared too, right? If I all I knew about Milwaukee was what I got from the news, of course Milwaukee would seem like a terrible, terrible place. And so then the solution that gets promoted or presented is policing. Mm-hmm. Right? And so you miss elements there of how it is that the public schools have been mismanaged, how it is that essential services like good access to healthcare, particularly mental health services, have been slashed in the last decade or so, like completely slashed. Mm. And so things like that that actually are contributing to quote-unquote public safety and community safety, right? Like when you think of a safe community, you think of a community that has good access to education, good access to parks, good access to safe recreational opportunities, access to
food,
exactly.
Food sovereignty, right? yes.
All of those things. And you just don't have that in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so instead of investing in those things, that, you know, if the city actually just changed the way it funds the city and actually chose to fund those things, that those services that were once there in Milwaukee, we wouldn't need to, there wouldn't be such a dire need for, quote unquote, you know, the safety of police and whatnot.
Right. Well, I want to take a moment to, a little bit of time actually, to talk about how I've gotten to know you, Alon, and hear how you feel about what's happening in Palestine. Alon and I serve on the executive committee of the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine and have for the last almost 7 months, I guess. And I've seen you on Zoom calls, and you're always so focused and prepared, and you inspire me. And I know facing the things that we face, we're willing to look at the some of the goriness that people don't want to see. We're willing to, you know, tackle the considerations of how can we make it different. Some people just give up. They can't do that. Some just accept it. Some fight it. And what I've watched in you is that you strategize. And you the thing that has touched me, I want to say this, is that you maintain your humanity and you recognize it in others. I've seen it. You're not afraid of hard discussions, and I really respect that. I think more of that is what we all need, more of what you've represented and that I see. But let's talk about, now that I've bragged you up, because you deserve it, let's talk about Palestine and why we're connected there.
Yeah, I appreciate that preface, you know, and I would also say, you know, how much I've appreciated organizing with you in that body as well, and you also emulating a lot of what you just stated about me, of that openness to the humanity of others and trying to take the time to understand things in, you know, these complexities. And so to the question of what's happening in Palestine, right, like, you know, at a basic level, even if people don't understand the history of that struggle or the history of how it is that you come to have, you know, Palestinian people, but then you have a state of Israel. even if you don't understand that, I think just seeing the starvation that Palestinians are facing, and this, even if you just see the last 7 months, this is something that's been going on for over 76 years, or almost 76 years. Even if you see that, or you see children who are now having to look for their loved ones who are buried beneath rubble, when you see parents in complete dismay because their kid is just laying there unconscious or possibly dead due to an airstrike, right? I mean, I don't know how someone can see that imagery and not feel something. Like, one of the most difficult images to make sense of was, I forget how long ago, I mean, it just, I know it's been 7 months, but it feels much longer than that, is the press conference that was held at the hospital.
Right.
I think it was the Al Shifa Hospital, and all the dead children, all the dead corpses were laying in front while people spoke. And if you can't see something just basically wrong with that, I mean, I think you need to take a deep look in the mirror and try to understand why it is that you're so desensitized to that imagery, and why it is that people don't feel a sense of devastation, of anger, of, I don't know, just a wide variety of emotions, but you feel something seeing that, right? And so, again, that's even not understanding the situation in whole, but if you see that and you don't feel compelled to try to put an end to it, even if it's taking an action like making phone calls to different politicians who might be, like, you know, different Congress people who might be able to vote against the funding of what's going on in Palestine, I mean, I don't know what else to say, right? So So that's definitely an element that I think people, if you don't know anything about the situation but you don't feel compelled by what you're watching, oof, I think there needs to be some work done there.
Absolutely, absolutely. I don't think we can say enough to try to have that come to an end. We say this a lot on the calls, that we can't all believe that it's still happening. You know, we came to the coalition with the idea that we could say something, do something, and some sanity would prevail, and it doesn't seem to keep happening. And a lot. But it sort of comes around to what's been happening over the last few days in the universities around the country. And it really dovetails. I know I was reading this morning about NYPD coming into college campuses and that being called into question.
So what we're seeing now, right, it's these struggles, right, they come in waves of sorts. The struggle for a while was, and still is, you know, taking up in streets with various forms of actions, right, different. And that's where the strategies come into place. You have to sustain a movement and make it effective, right? And so early on, we saw a lot of more massive demonstrations in the streets. That's one way, right, of when it's fresh, people have that energy, and so you see it, right? But that's not sustainable, just keeping people marching without any direction. So then you see a little bit of transitioning towards, you know, putting pressure on elected officials through different demonstrations. But the one area that has been so inspiring to see in the last several months, and now heightening in the last several days, is the fight for Palestine within universities and college campuses.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been remarkable to see how clear students are, and also seeing community come out in support of students.
Right.
And that's something that I see often missing, of a connection, a clear connection between the students who come in to a campus and the community. Because oftentimes we think of student populations as sort of transitory, right? Like they come in, they're temporary members of wherever they're, you know, let's say Milwaukee or Madison being the two big hubs in Wisconsin. They come in, do their 4 to 5 years, and then they leave, right? And so we don't think of them as oftentimes as members of the community, or we keep them sort of isolated into a college campus or wherever there is, right? And say, okay, that's where the college students live. But this goes to show, right, the when you bring the community close to students and vice versa, you're able to do these remarkable actions, such as what we're seeing in Columbia. We're now seeing it in Michigan. I just heard of in Twin Cities, right, in Minnesota, at the University of Minnesota. And I know today there were several students arrested there. And so what's remarkable there is not just students deciding to put pressure in these remarkable ways, but also community members coming to be in unity with the students and bailing students out. Also these encampments, you know, I know you know a lot about these in your experiences too. You know, these, it's difficult to sustain them.
And, yeah.
you got to keep morale up. You got to keep people fed. You got to keep people moving and staying on this. And it requires a lot of external support too.
Yes, it does. And, you know, it's been interesting because it's so clear that the call for divestment. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things, and I think it's so important. And I can see it heightening. When it first came out, when divestment was first discussed, you know, years ago, people it was easy to be squashed. It was easy to be pushed away as radical or whatever. But there's a re-education happening because I'm watching it, I'm listening to it, like on certain radio programs. People are understanding that the boycott divestment that occurred for South Africa really was significant, and it does play a role. And I think that it's really interesting watching the connections that are being made. And even among my generation, the people who were on college campuses to stop and did the anti-war era, they're going, oh yeah, this, I remember this. It's like this an awakening happening. And I just, you know, I hope that it can just continue and get stronger. You know, and you see, like I was saying, they want to bring in the police, and you know, and one of the things we didn't talk about with policing is how much policing has become militarized.
Right.
You know, I saw it at Standing Rock. I mean, it was, wow, you know, what we were up against there. And how they finish with these some of this equipment, and next thing you know, it's in our cities. Mm-hmm. And people need to really take a good look at that, because we pride ourselves on freedom of speech and all this, but at the same time, I have friends who were at Kent State. Mm-hmm. They're still here, but they remember. You know, so I don't know. It's an interesting moment in time. And I'm hoping that even with this conversation today, it wakes up some thinking, that people are like, oh, yeah, I need to learn more about this.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you raised that question of the militarization of the police. I'll have to get that the exact policy again, but there's policies at the state level that allow Wisconsin law enforcement to participate in basically exchange programs, where they receive different weapons and different arsenal, military-grade arsenal. So like you were saying, once the U.S. military is done, sometimes they don't even use the equipment, they just keep producing it, right? Like, you know, the endless funding we see for the war machine. And so you'll end up with small local, you know, law enforcement agencies with just ridiculous grades of weaponry. So what does a small town sheriff's department do with a tank?
Yeah. Right? I don't want to know. Yes.
It's completely ridiculous and absurd to think about, but you see it here in Milwaukee in 2020 and 2021. That summer of 2020, there were two big waves of struggle. One in Kenosha, which, you know, you mentioned Kent State, and I think it was last week that Kyle Rittenhouse was actually a guest speaker at Kent State.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, some students brought him, and I'm just like, wow, like the how it is that the history of an institution like Kent State that has such, you know, it's one of those places that when you hear that, and if you know anything about student movement and activism, Kent State's one of those names that should resonate, right?
Right.
To see it, you know, several, you know, decades later, having a guest speaker like the likes of Kyle Rittenhouse. But anyways, you know our group was the first group that was actually in on the ground in Kenosha when Jacob Blake was shot.
Mm.
And so we saw it unfold. And what we saw was, because a lot of our members moved up to Milwaukee from Kenosha, so they know Kenosha quite well. They grew up there.
Mm.
And, yeah, you know, they were like, they knew that policing was bad because they had, you know, experiences there as, you know, young men of color, as Chicanos growing up in Kenosha. They experienced a lot of the racism there. But when we saw the tanks rolling in, and these weren't just National Guard ones, like these were, they had, you know, KPD written on them.
Mm.
So they were bringing out a lot of the arsenal in Kenosha that you're just like how does that exist in a small town like Kenosha, right?
Mm.
And same thing when in Wauwatosa, which is a municipality just west, like a little suburb just west of Milwaukee. You also had here, when the protests were happening, you know, they had these vehicles that were like the ones you see in that the U.S. sends to Iraq and Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like rolling through a street, right, or a residential street, you see this big tank-looking thing just roaming around.
Yeah, we've been spending too much time watching movies.
Right.
You know, it's like we've just got this machismo, you know, approach to everything. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, somehow we have to keep changing that narrative. But I want to take a moment to let our listeners know that they're listening to WDRT's Conversations. My name is Dina Eccles. And my guest is Alon Chavoya. And Alon has been talking a lot about helping to change the mindset, the approaches of police. And, well, we've covered a lot of things, actually, and this podcast will be available for those of you who might have missed the bulk of it, but you're welcome to go back and listen again because I think there's some really important issues that Alon has brought up. So these are things that I know we could turn around. I know we can change the things that we've been talking about, but we need to hear one another. We need to listen, and we need to reduce that fear, so much fear, you know, and labeling of other. It's very hard. But I wanted to ask you, you know, you have really expressed that this has been, you know, your life's work and how you've journeyed through it. And so how do you maintain your clarity? How do you take care of yourself, Alon? What do you do?
Yeah, you know, it's not an individual effort. It really does require being with other people, and I think that's been the big lesson for me. The more I see it, the more I understand my upbringing. It's because I had a strong support system around me that I've been able to keep myself afloat. Whether it was, you know, being raised by, you know, very loving parents who made incredible sacrifices for myself and for my siblings, and being around different communities, to now in this level of organizing, just knowing that there's people I can rely on, and knowing that it's not just me, right? It's not about me who's responsible for doing everything. But it's about working in this together.
Mm.
And that gives me a lot of, it keeps me motivated. It gives me what we call, you know, it gives you this revolutionary optimism where things will change. Like, things are terrible, right? But things will change.
Yeah.
And it just keeps you going. So keeping that mindset of being able to rely on each other, on my friends, on my comrades, that we're saying, you know, we're in this together. And even though some days it's tough to want to do certain things, just, you know, there's others doing it. And so it kind of motivates me. So there's that. I also have a very loving wife. She's a yoga instructor and a sound healer.
Oh, great. Oh, that's good.
So I'm sort of her guinea pig at times when she's trying to test out new instruments. So to me, that's not just me, you know, supporting her. It's also me getting like a free sound bath out of it. 30 minutes of me just laying there, meditating of sorts, listening to these beautiful instruments and getting me grounded. So that helps me a lot, and yeah. I didn't realize how much that helps me.
So that is great.
Little practices like that, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's great. I loved your answer to that. I had a feeling you would be clear about that. And your sense of community, the community around you, I think that is such a key. You know, it's what when I went to Standing Rock, it was the thing that I just was so blown away by, was how everyone treated one another. And, you know, just meeting one another, but, you know, the indigenous sense of community and respect was palpable. And I so appreciated it because I guess I kind of had that a bit when I was young, very young, but then it seemed like it dissolved into all this fractionalism, you know? Mm-hmm. And I always say that, you know, it would really help the dominant culture to realize again, to remember again, community in the truest sense. You know, it's like a lot of people have, well, I have my church and, you know, and that's it. But, or they go to a certain club or whatever. But that bigger sense of community, that we're in this together. And that's why I said earlier that, you know, I've seen you dive into some heavy conversations, even with your comrades, you know, even with the people, because it's not like we all agree on everything, the approaches we should take or how we should talk about things. We, you know, we're very different. And appreciating that difference in one another, I think, is also key.
Definitely. So, and you bring up some very, you know, interesting points that I think get us back to the opening of this conversation when you asked me about just sort of my journey, and I got a little bit into my love for philosophy. Because in it, right, there's a distinct way of operating and existing that when you draw from non-Western, non-sort of that modern notion of the self as very hyper-individual, right? When you draw from the non-Western approaches, the approaches that you see in a lot of indigenous philosophy here in the Americas, that you had in the Mexicas and other indigenous, you know, thinkers throughout the Americas, as well as African thinkers and Asian thinkers, you get this sense of self that's not individualistic, right? It's a very holistic sense that it's indispensable from being with each other. And so it gets you to that sense of communal being with each other that was really, you know, something that, you know, one of the few classes that can be alert in was some of those classes where I was able to read this type of philosophy, and it became really interesting to me of how it is that, you know, you mentioned the Standing Rock, how it is that groups were able to form those bonds, right? Of it's not just about me and taking care of myself, but in order to do that, you have to take care of each other, right? And so that's something that really resonates, and I think is really important when organizing, of organizing with one another, of this level of love towards each other that I think highlights that humanity, and because it's not just this romantic notion of love, but it's a love to say, I'm willing to struggle things with you. And so this is something that in the Alliance, when we definitely love each other, but that doesn't mean it's all, you know, this romanticized notion of it. It's a struggle. And I think that's what's so important. And when we do struggle things with each other, like whether it's debating our strategy, or sometimes, you know, we don't all see the things, we don't always see eye to eye on things, but when we struggle something out, we do it for the sake of unity. So we want to get back to a level of unity when we're practicing this, right? It's not just, oh, I disagree with what you said and now I'm leaving. No, it's not a luxury to leave. It's like, it's a relationship, right? It's we struggle. Okay, how can we find back? How can we reach again this level of unity that we need so that we're not fractured from one another?
Right.
So that we can continue to be together and continue to struggle against the systems that we want to struggle against, so that we can have that brighter future that we're all fighting for.
Lovely, lovely way to say it. And yes, using that word love, it's one of my favorites, because it has to be there. The unity has to be there. And it will allow you, you know, you're right. A lot of times it's like, I'm just going to walk away. And I've walked away from things, but I've never, it's funny, you know, I've never, some of the things that I walked away from, I didn't really walk away. I kept working, waiting for this moment. I don't know if this is making sense, but I've waited for the moment where a bigger recognition of our humanity could happen, you know, where we weren't just fighting over little, you know, issues, how to, you know, how to organize, you know, these little things. It's like, no, there's a bigger thing that we need to be aware of. So yeah, this is a, for me, it's a really sweet time in my life. You know, I get to have conversations with people like you. I get to find you. A long time ago, it was during the Occupy movement in New York. I'll never forget this. There was a woman who I was reading about it, Occupy, and she said, "We're finding one another," and I was like, "Oh yeah, I like that." You know, we're finding one another, because this silo mentality, these separations that we've carried for so long, that, you know, and for some of us, it's really deeply ingrained in us, you know, my way or the highway. Mm-hmm. You know, and if it's not good for me, it's not going to happen, you know, that kind of thing. But so I feel like whatever we can do to change that narrative and allow the voice of peace, they allow the voice of humanity to come forward a little stronger, I think that we can see change, can see it coming.
Yeah, definitely.
So I want to make sure that you get to tell people how they can find the organizations that you're part of. If, you know, because they might want to read more. I found a lot on the website. MAARPR.org, right?
Yep, that's our website, and we're still in the it's a newer website, so we're still trying to, you know, you could say beautify it. We're new to web development, so we're working with some people to make it more professional, so it's a work in progress, so we'll get it there.
Yeah, but the information's there. And even though some of it's dated, quote-unquote, you know, it's a couple years old, but it's still really important. How you're expressing it, and you do have a Facebook page as well, Milwaukee Alliance Facebook page.
Yep.
And then of course there's the Wisconsin Coalition for Justice in Palestine, that people could and should be checking on, and there's Instagram and website for that. If you want to learn more. So what other things, you know, in our last few minutes, really, we didn't mention the Cop City. Should we?
Right. Yeah, we could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, let's do that.
We'll keep it brief, because I think that one links the struggle for, that we're seeing now, for the liberation of Palestine, as well as the liberation of particularly Black and brown people here in the United States. So this Cop City, people have probably heard the term Cop City, and it's not, you know, there's actually a couple of Cop Cities in Wisconsin that have been built or being approved right now. So the Cop City is a term that was given to a training facility out in Atlanta, Georgia, that is a hundreds of million dollars, you know, we're talking about, yeah, hundreds of millions of dollars, this training facility that was going to basically emulate a quote-unquote urban setting to train police officers in different tactics for how to respond to quote-unquote crises. So they're allocating these funds to these cities that are, like I said, they're miniature cities being built to train police officers. And so what they do is, you can't just, you know, create a city out of nowhere. You have to build it somewhere. So in Atlanta, they're trying to tear down the forest. And I don't know if people have ever been to Atlanta, but it's a beautiful green space. People don't think of it that way, but the city of Atlanta is surrounded by a beautiful, beautiful forest. And so imagine just the amount of, you know, environmental damage that building this huge city inside of a forest would do. So you had a lot of forest defenders and a lot of different people, community organizations come together to demand an end to the proposal of a Cop City in Atlanta. And so it led to a very important struggle that's been ongoing for several years. It's become violent with the police actually killing one of the activists, one of the forest defenders. They called them Tortuguita.
Right.
And so they shot Tortuguita multiple times. And
while in a
so
tree.
And unarmed.
Right.
And so you have the city of Atlanta trying to bypass the desires of the community of Atlanta, who doesn't, you know, the majority of people don't want this being built because, again, it's going to destroy the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it also means that it's going to further militarize the police, something that Atlanta police definitely doesn't need more of. And so yeah. The struggle has become very heightened there. But there's cop cities all throughout the U.S., and that's something that people don't recognize.
Hmm.
Here in Wisconsin, we have a training facility that's it's not as big, but it's still a pretty big training facility for law enforcement in Neenah. So it's sort of like, you know, on
yeah,
the
it's
east.
Close by. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. And the other one that they want to build now is in Fitchburg, you know, really close to Madison, so even closer by, right?
Yeah, so this has been really important to thank you, by the way, for covering that. I knew that you would. All of the things that we talked about today are really important for people to take in. I know it's hard. I know it's not easy. It doesn't really pertain maybe in your immediate life or so you think, but it's really, really important that we look at how do we want to live and what is the legacy we want to leave to our children, our grandchildren. How do we want to leave this world? Divided and broken. So I want to, we have to wrap it up now, Alon, but you got to talk about your lovely wife and I'm going to talk about mine. You know, we were together down at one of the rallies, the pro-Palestinian rallies in Milwaukee, and you were speaking and you said, we can make the world the place we want it to be and we can do it in our lifetime. And when I told her, Lauren, that I was going to be speaking with you today, she said that that was the most important thing that she had heard, and she was really happy to hear that we were going to be talking. I know that's an understanding that the three of us commonly share, but I think more people have it as well. So if we can bring that hope back, then that's what we want to do. So thank you for taking the time to talk to me, my friend, my brother.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for the invitation. I can't believe it's already been an hour.
I know. It just whips through. It's just great. But we're going to do it again. We're going to do it again. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And remember, you can share this, and please do share it. It'll be listed as a podcast very soon on WDRT. So thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful day.